My guest today is Jennifer Churchill, who is a writer, and she wrote this wonderful classic Hollywood film children's book, which I love, which is right behind me here, called Movies Are Magic, which just came out a few years ago. Jennifer, welcome. Thanks so much for joining me today.
Thank you for having me, Robert.
I love the book, and I got it partly because I was trying to get my own son interested in classic films, but since he rebels on anything I like, it's an upward struggle. But I heard that you said in another podcast that you went to the TCM, you know, festival years ago, and you found that the age demographic, you know, is mostly a lot of older people. And this was a reason why you felt you should write a book for kids to get interested in this period, or else there will be no, you know, TCM festivals. And, you know, let's say 20 years or 30 years from now, I couldn't agree more. So what is it about the period that you think is important?
Honestly, I see there's this linear connection from just humans having the need to tell stories before film was ever even invented, and, you know, cave paintings and language and communication. And I have the invention of the Gutenberg press is mentioned in my book. And
right.
So it's just this need for humans to tell stories to make sense of the world around us. And I just think movies are magical, hence the title.
Yes.
It brings in so many art forms, the writer, the actors, the directors, the scene artists, musicians. It really brings in every single art form. And then it gets distilled down into this, you know, 90-minute work of art that reflects reality sometimes, and sometimes fantasy that informs our reality. And I think kids today who are walking around watching YouTube videos and funny cat videos on streaming devices,
right?
I think it's important for them to know where that came from.
Yes, no, I totally agree. And when you hear people, you know, because, you know, people who are even a little younger than me, or even sometimes older than me, there is this general sort of thinking that the classic Hollywood period is boring, black and white movies, and that the acting is bad, and that it's old fashioned and stuff like that. I mean, how, you know, for people who are possibly only really interested in movies coming out now, or in, you know, there's so many television series on Netflix and Amazon, and we're taking in so much nowadays, it's hard to even know what's going on in a way. I mean, what would you say to, like, someone, let's say even pushing 30, who's totally not interested? Is there something about these movies in the content of the movies that you think holds up, or what is it for you?
Yeah, well, I'm kind of weird, and I've liked these movies since I was a little kid. So I'm not the average person, and I realize that. And I have my entryway movies for my friends who say, oh, old black and white movies are boring. And I have my short list of movies that I try to convince them otherwise, because they can start a little slow for modern audiences. There's not a lot of editing. There are no explosions.
Right.
There's not very much swearing, very little sex, unless you're watching Pre-Codes.
Yes.
To the whole different subject. But I think if they want to be cool, if that's an attractive reason for someone to want to dig into these movies, or at least expose themselves to these movies, you're going to understand references made in modern movies. Quentin Tarantino is constantly making references to classic movies and old movies, and you don't get it if you haven't seen the movies that he's, you know, that are being referenced. And it's kind of like an insider joke sometimes. And even TV shows and series, people will make an offhand comment, or they'll quote Claude Rains from Casablanca or something. And if you've never seen those movies, you don't get it. And
right.
So that if just from a wanting to get the joke standpoint, I think that might be an appealing reason. But I would say that these movies are unexpectedly funny and entertaining to people when I do show them. You know, you don't want to start with Citizen Kane. I think that might
be
a turnoff for some people, that movie's not for everyone. And you really do have to know the history to have an appreciation for it. It's not the most exciting movie in the world.
Right.
And there's a lot of, you know, film first, and his directing was amazing and all of that. But it's not just great escapism for escapism's sake. But I would say movies like Some Like It Hot with Marilyn Monroe, where Jack Lemmon and Tony Curtis dress and drag and pretend they're in a girls band, and all the sexual innuendo and you know, mistaken identity and all that stuff. It's hilarious. And I have friends watch it and say, oh my God, that was so funny. And they had no idea. So I try to find movies like that to sort of trick them into liking the old movies. And The Thin Man is another another one. And I said, that's the way I'll get my friends to watch it is I'll say, they just drink through the whole movie. And they're like, what, an old movie? I'm like, that's all they do.
Right.
I like to share some little factoids with friends to get them excited. You know, I'll say like The Thin Man, it's one of the funniest movies ever. It's got a great ending. You're going to love this couple. They're the cutest on-screen couple of all time. I always, you know, if I post something about Nick and Nora from The Thin Man, I'll, you know, use hashtag relationship goals because they trust each other, but they make fun of each other. And he's always making jokes about, you know, don't lose all that money I married you for. And but you can tell they have like a genuine natural affection. They had a great on-screen chemistry, but they filmed that movie in 14 days.
Oh, and I didn't even know that.
Like, the 2 weeks done.
Wow.
So it's just amazing to me that the talent that performers had back then, and they had to be the triple threat. They had to be able to sing, act, and dance. And I always say the quadruple threat. They had to be good looking too.
Right.
That was like the fourth qualification. You have to look good on camera.
So, it's true. I mean, there certainly were. You know, those, I always like the oddballs, like, you know, Sterling Hayden later and Robert Ryan, who look like every man, you know, and now we still see a lot of these men and women who are so good looking. And I'm like, and I always think back to even though like it was the same band, Cary Grant and people, Marilyn Monroe, they're very, very attractive, but I'm like, where are the Robert Ryans? Where are the where's you know, Sterling Hayden? And I don't, those guys who look like they just claim came out of a sewer are now are on the set. Right. You don't see those kind of faces. Like, I'm just like, wow. I mean, I'm sure they're out there, but I certainly don't see it as much. We're obviously looking back at the best of the best. I mean, there were, you know, I was shocked when I recently reviewed Little Caesar, for example. And apparently from, and you may know this, but apparently from 1931 to 1936, they did in Hollywood something like hundreds of gangster films. But today we think of Little Caesar, we think of Public Enemy, and we don't think of like, you know, they even did, you know, Frankenstein Meets a Gangster kind of thing. Like they were just running out of ideas. But at the same time, so many of these movies are still so relevant. Like just recently, I saw Bigger Than Life with James Mason. And I was like, oh my God, everything that this film is saying about people losing their individuality and being so interested in money and just acquiring things and just losing themselves in the process. And you saw a real stigma against mental health in that film. And I just thought, wow, like this is 1956, you know? So I think just this saying that this whole thing that these movies don't hold up, I mean, so many of them hold up, you know, like just incredibly well. I mean, I'm not saying all of them do, but there are so many. So I always encourage people to look at the past. And I think Scorsese put it well when he told, you know, filmmakers, you should watch older films from all over the world, because it's just another, you know, color on the palette that you can then use towards your painting, so to speak, instead of only looking at what you know, or maybe the last like 20 years or so. There's a whole other, you know, form of filmmaking and use of humor and writing and things that you don't see as often anymore. So I certainly think it's important, but also at the same time, just great storytelling.
The writing used to be better.
Yeah, I think in a lot of ways it was. And I think this, there's sort of this combination of like always having humor. I think nowadays I see it's either like a strict comedy or it's a strict drama. And mm-hmm. it's either, and then, you know, I look at something like Ace in the Hole, which is a very dark film. Again, a film that still holds up so well in terms of its critique of the not, you know, always trusting the media, so to speak. Yeah. I was interviewing someone about that, and he goes, "I'm not talking like fake news," because he was a writer and he hates that word, but just, you know, not everything is necessarily accurate, and we're so like media drenched nowadays. And you look at that film, and it really holds up, but at the same time had this wonderful sense of humor of like Kirk Douglas off the top in a car getting towed as he's reading a newspaper. I mean, that just says it all about where he was at in that one shot. is that what you see as being better back then, the humor, or is it something else you see?
I feel like the writing was tighter, and it was like that witty banter. I love I love banter, even like Double Indemnity, you know, they're flirtatious banter, and it's just so bam, bam, bam. And
line
delivery, and the writing was just, it was like kind of tongue in cheek almost, but sexy. And I don't know. There's like so much going on where you're like, it's just so fun. It's fun to watch. And I think it was Lauren Bacall said that, it's only, what did she say? Something like it's new if you've never seen it, or, you know, it's not an old movie if you've never seen it.
It's brand new.
The quote is, but if you've never seen it, it doesn't really matter when it was made. It's still new to you, and it's still something to discover. And I really think people are surprised when they watch some of these older movies. Yeah. And I know growing up, just seeing like the Sunday afternoon classics before, you know, Turner Classic Movies launched and all of that. And there wasn't very much access to classic movies, just sort of what would show up on PBS on a Sunday afternoon. And I thought like classic movies, I thought there was this tiny little bundle of these old movies. I thought there was, you know, Gone with the Wind, Casablanca, The Wizard of Oz. And then I didn't realize until Turner Classic Movies launched, really, that there was this, there's no way you could ever see every movie ever made. And there's so many films lost that we'll never get to see, that we know the history of, we know they were made, and, you know, they burned in a fire because they were on nitrate or whatever, it's gone forever. And so I think the more you learn and discover and look into old movies, the more exciting it gets.
Oh no, I absolutely agree. And speaking of Turner Classic Movies, I know that you've been going to the festival for, you know, a number of times since 2009. And have you found the demographic has changed since they've started in terms of the age?
Yeah, actually, I don't know if they've just done a better job marketing for the festival. And I don't know TCM's inside numbers on their viewership demographics or anything like that. But I know just anecdotally from going to the festival myself. So I went to the very first festival, which was in 2010. They started advertising it in 2009. And I was living in Michigan at the time.
Right.
In the winter, in my cold house with my dog. And I live in California now, partially for that festival, but kind of got me out here. But I was, you know, I remember sitting in the cold in the winter and seeing a commercial for 4 days in Hollywood of classic movies and these historic venues and just 9 a.m. to midnight every day, classic movies. And I'm like, I'm going to that. So the first one I went to, I think there was less than 1,000 people, not 25,000 or so people go now pre-COVID. Who knows what will happen in 2022, but.
Wow, that's a huge jump from 700.
It's just grown. So it was just kind of like random nerds like myself and mostly an older audience. And there were a lot of movie stars at the first one, like Cher and Chris Isaac and Norman Lloyd and Alec Baldwin. And I mean, we were just sort of hanging out with all these stars. It was a more low key event. It was new and small. So I met a lot of really cool people. I met all the executives at TCM. I hung out with Robert Osborne for like an entire evening, just sat, you know, hanging out with him.
What was he like? I've heard that he's exactly as he is on the show. Just so kind. Was that your experience? Yes.
Yes. And I'll tell you the short version of how I actually met him, because I was super excited to meet him. My friends jokingly called him my boyfriend because he was in my living room every night, even though, you know, I think he dated women, but
right.
I had, you know, my crush on, you know, the older gent. And
he's a classy guy. I don't blame him.
Yeah, he was just classic. I just loved classic movies, and I loved his intros, and I loved the dynamic he would have when he did interviews with the old stars, because you could tell he knew them and was friends with them.
So good. Such a great interviewer. And a lot of them you can see on YouTube. I mean, they're great.
Yeah. So I was really excited to meet him more than, you know, movie stars. And so I'd gone to this after party the first night of the festival. It's like it was a small party where they have like bacon wrapped shrimp and fancy cocktails. And Cher was there. All these people were there. And I was waiting in line to go to the bathroom on these steps. And I stepped out of the way of this very nicely dressed older woman. And I just sort of was like, oh, excuse me, ma'am. Go ahead. You know, get in front of me, just being polite. And then I looked at her. I did like a double take. I'm like, oh, Miss Eva Marie Saint. And
oh, she's wow.
Like, oh, bless your heart for recognizing me. I'm going to introduce North by Northwest tomorrow. She's just all sweet and so classy. So she looked beautiful still. I think she was in her 70s then, maybe. But she was beautiful, lovely. And so we're chatting in line, waiting for the bathroom. And I said, well, you know, she said something like, don't ask me what it was like to kiss Cary Grant. What do you think it was like to kiss Cary Grant? I'm like, oh, lucky you. And then I said, well, as a matter of fact, I'm really here to meet Robert Osborne. And she said, oh, you haven't met him yet? And I said, no, I'm kind of shy. You know, I'd love to go meet him. And he was sitting at this round booth table in the back with TCM execs on either side of him, you know, kind of not easy to get to him at this party. Mm-hmm. And she said, can you hold your pee? I'm like, sure. She grabbed my hand and she dragged me across the room. And she said, Robert, this is my friend, Jennifer.
Oh my God.
I have to go to the bathroom, but you guys move out of the way, Jennifer. You sit right there next to Robert. And they all moved out of the way. I sat down in the booth and he kept patting my hand. He's like, well, aren't you lovely? Oh, so tell me what are your favorite classic movies? And I mean, he was just exactly like you would think he was a gentleman. He you know, treated everyone that he talked to exactly the same, with the same interest level and wanting to know what you loved about old movies. He was super genuine about it, and it was awesome. So I feel lucky I got to meet him. And then I, you know, over the years I knew him because I'd met him at that first one. And so I'm really sad he's gone.
Yeah, I know. That's such an incredible story. I mean, was your heart just pounding as, first of all, Eva Marie Saint, is you meet her and then she walking you over to like these executive suite? Like, that must have, I think I would have been tongue-tied.
I just gave myself into it. I'm like, this is surreal. And
yeah,
you know, I didn't have the guts to go talk to Cher. I was too intimidated for that.
Next time, maybe.
But, yeah. But really, I just sort of felt it was a magical experience that first year. And the most memorable thing was sitting in a full movie theater. I'd been watching these classic movies by myself in my living room for years. You know, like we were talking earlier, I couldn't, you know, my friends are like, we want to watch Sex and the City. You know, they didn't want to watch what I was watching. And so it was sort of something I experienced on my own for the most part. And to sit in a full movie theater and have everyone laughing at Claude Rains's lines at the same time I was, and just like, I'm like, oh my God, these are my people, is what it felt like. It was, so that was the most amazing part of going to the festival, was realizing there's all these other people who love big movies the same. And, you know, to go back to what you'd asked about the demographics of who attends, and I've definitely seen like more like hipster types.
Right.
Not to categorize people, but, you know, I would say there's more people in their 30s and, you know, early 40s. And even you have to be 13, I think, to attend the festival. But, I've seen people bring their teenage kids, you know, their older teenage kids come with them, and they get into it. And I think, you know, how our kids resist the things that we push in front of them, but still it's there. And probably when they're older, they'll come back to it. Even if they are like, oh, I don't want to watch that. That's mom's thing or that's dad's thing. It's still there. They're still exposed to it. And I think that's important. And we could segue to Top Hat, because when Weston, my now 7-year-old, was 2, that was his favorite movie. But those tap dancing movies, I would say, are a good, there's nothing offensive in it for a little kid to see. So if you're going to have something on for your little one, which I know we all want to limit screen time for our kids, especially when they're little, but I would put on Top Hat when he was 2. And then I bought him these little tap shoes because he liked the sound, and he couldn't really actually tap dance, but he would sort of like tap dance along with the dance sequences of that movie. And it would always catch his attention. And so, you know, it's there in his brain. He's going to grow up with an affection for.
Oh, I love it. I tried to watch Top Hat with my son, and it was just a flat out no.
He's older. You have to get him when you have to brainwash him when they're, you know, infants.
Yeah. I should have tried, you know, 5-6 years ago, but you're right. Cause you know, that the, you know, I must admit, I have never seen any of the Fred Astaire, Ginger Roger films. I mean, there's always just those, even if you're a classic film fan or what, there's always those few that people just have not gotten to yet. But the dance numbers when they were all, you know, singing and dancing, I was floored at how seamless it all seemed. I mean, it just seemed, I just couldn't believe that. I'm like, how can you dance that well? And then I read afterwards that and I think Fred Astaire was right in not wanting to have cuts during the dances, to have it all in one shot so that people can really focus on the dance instead of giving it in bits. And that led to, you know, and he was such a perfectionist apparently that he was take after take after take after take. And because I was actually wondering.
They had bleeding feet, I had read.
Yeah, I read that because I was wondering, I'm like, okay, I mean, obviously you can't, it seems, you know, perfect, but obviously anything there's a lot of work that goes into it. But I was just floored by how incredible their talent was. And even I think it added to their rapport with their acting because they worked off each other, you know, so beautifully. You can see them listening and really responding. And it wasn't, you know, again, as people think that the acting back then was bad. I mean, there was bad acting then, of course, and perhaps general sort of way there was a hamminess at times, but there are some incredible, subtle and powerful performances from every single decade. And you know, just watching the two of them, not being hammy at all, not pushing it, not going, it was just a real simple connection that I just thought was so powerful. I mean, does the performances also stand out to you in this, on top of the dancing and the singing?
Yeah, a lot of people say, I think Swing Time is their favorite, but I sort of don't like the whole Bojangles and he's in blackface. That whole sequence is like,
right, yeah,
awkward to watch.
Yeah.
I've always felt that way about it. Like, I just don't love that movie. It just kind of has those elements, even though of course artistically and dance wise, it's fantastic. But Top Hat's my favorite Fred Astaire movie. Absolutely. Yeah. Number one favorite. I think it's funny. Edward Horton is in it, who is one of my favorite character actors of all time. He's so funny in it and so great. I love him.
He was the producer, right? With Fred Astaire's. Yes, he was great. Funny. And also great performance by him, Edward Horton, you're right. And his wife, to the woman who played his wife, Helen Broderick. I just thought, wow. Edge. I mean, not hammy, not over the top. Really simple, and yet just wow, the timing, everything. The only ones, and I not that I'm saying their acting was necessarily bad, because the was Bates and Alberto, but they're playing like archetypes, you know. So it's very it's meant to be sort of really silly. I actually read that apparently Mussolini banned the film in Italy because of the portrayal of Alberto Bedini he felt was offensive towards Italians. And as an Italian myself, I'm like, yeah, he's doing the stereotypical caricature. But I just thought, wow, like they actually banned it in I don't know if you ever read that. I read it last night.
But But if something gets banned, it just makes me want to see it even more.
So. I know Fred Astaire apparently had said that he never really liked the story of the film. He felt that there really was no story. And I mean, to me, it's a very simple love story, but it's a farce. Yeah. And farce is hard to pull off. But I thought the way in which, you know, I'll be here forever to go into all the details of the plot. I don't want to spoil the whole thing. But they sort of handled the, you know, he can't see this person or he can't see this person because it gives away all the hidden mm-hmm. identities and so on and so forth.
It's very Shakespearean, really.
Exactly. That's what I thought.
You know.
Yeah.
Mistaken identities. And I thought you were married to her, but he's married to you, you know, and all of that.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. That's like Twelfth Night, you know, like so many Shakespeare plays had those same elements.
Yeah. And this is a totally random thing, but here's a Robert Osborne connection too. I've watched Top Hat many, many times. Like, you know, I said, I've been showing it to my son since he was two and I'd seen it many times. I've probably seen it over 20 times. And I always noticed the flower girl in the flower shop when Fred Astaire goes into the flower shop in the hotel and he keeps ordering all the flowers they have to send them to Ginger Rogers because he's trying to woo her. And there's a female with blonde hair working in the flower shop and something about her always caught my attention. I'm like, her voice sounds familiar. I don't know, but she doesn't get a full.
Yeah. It's her side profile.
It's Lucille Ball.
Yeah. I read that last night.
Okay.
Yeah.
I found that out like a couple of weeks ago. And so I kept watching it. I'm like, yeah, that is her. I just had never known that, but I finally looked.
You can't tell. Yeah, I mean, you can barely tell, but yeah, she's got like platinum blonde hair.
Yeah, they dyed her hair. And I don't even think she gets a screen credit. She's not.
No, yeah, it says uncredited, which is unusual because even if you have one line, you get a credit, but maybe back then it was different. You know, 90s.
That's a fun little factoid for people to look for. So it's fun when you find out those things, you know, talking about getting people who think they don't like these old movies, you know, you can find some little nuggets like that and say, you're like, well, you know, I love Lucy.
Exactly.
You know, just look for her, see if you can find her. And I do that with my son. I got him to watch all of Casablanca with me.
Oh, how'd that go?
by pointing out the letters of transit being hidden in the piano. You know, spoiler alert for anyone who's not seen Casablanca, but how he hides, Humphrey Bogart hides the letters. They're the MacGuffin of the whole movie. You know,
right.
Everyone wants the letters of transit. So I pointed that out to my son, Weston. And then the whole movie, every time they were in Rick's, he's like, don't they know those letters of transit are in that piano, mommy? And he was so into it and so into whether someone was going to find them.
Right. The suspense, right? The suspenseful
moment.
Sometimes
you have to I'll find something to draw his attention to that I know is something that he might be more intrigued by. He doesn't care about the romance, you know.
No, that's a really good idea. I'll have to remember that for my little one. And I know, of course, so you have Top Hat in.
Oh yeah, here
in the book. I got it right here for and so why did you pick? I mean, it must have been very difficult to narrow down the film choices, I imagine. So you know, Top Hat is like one of the main musicals you discuss. Mm-hmm. And I love the way you did it because it has, you know, we start with, you know, the early silent films, moving into color, moving into dialogue, musicals, horror films. I thought that you really nailed down all of these major changes up until 1940. So, but how did you really pick the right film? Did you just follow your instincts with what you thought people would know, or how did that go?
So yeah, there was twice as many before we went to press, and I wanted to put much more in there. But really we kept talking about what's the goal is to get like be an introduction and get kids to be aware of these films in just a basic kind of fundamental way. And so I had to be talked into like cutting some things out, and some of them we had to pull out because of copyright considerations. I actually wrote to the Charlie Chaplin estate and got written approval from them to include a likeness of Charlie Chaplin.
Oh, wow.
I'm friends with many people in Buster Keaton's family, and they are 100% in support of anything that promotes Buster Keaton. And they were, you know, no problem, but a few things we cut out. We actually had to remove an image of the red ruby slippers in the Wizard of Oz image because MGM owns the rights to the red ruby slippers.
Oh my God. I didn't realize it would be that picky.
And I could have done it. So the intellectual property copyright lawyer who reviewed the book for me, he basically said, he's like, well, anyone can sue you for anything, but he red flagged a few things. He's like, you know, they protect this pretty closely. And if you don't want to deal with it or worry about it, maybe just take those out. If it doesn't impact your goal in the book to get kids excited about it. So nobody said, no, you can't. It was more just him
overabundance. Being cautious. Yeah.
Yeah. That makes sense. So the images of the characters in the Wizard of Oz image, you'll see. It's the illustrator.
Yeah, I have it here.
Yeah, we had them. So those characters, are the way they're defined in the book, the actual book, which is in the public domain. So we just removed a few MGM specific elements, like I think they're silver slippers in the book. And so we just took that out. But no, nobody was mean to us or said you have to, but we sort of just, I'm like, well, why deal with that if the goal is to get kids introduced to films and excited? And so I had started working on this book, I think 2016, 2017, when my son was little still. And I sent an email to Jennifer Dorian at Turner Classic Movies. She was the general manager at the time. She's not there anymore. But I wrote in the subject line, audience development. And I said, you know, we keep talking about everyone, film fans, the network, everyone's afraid there won't be a future audience for these movies. Right. And she emailed me back like 10 minutes later. She's like, this is a great idea. So Ben Mankiewicz wrote the introduction. He's one of the main hosts, and he has a daughter about Weston's age. I think his daughter's 8. I think now she's a little bit older. He writes about her in the intro that he too wants his daughter to love these movies as well.
Yeah, no, I love the intro. I think every now and then he's posted, I believe on his Instagram, like a little video where he's trying to, where he's putting on like Singing in the Rain with her.
Oh yeah, saw that.
or something along those lines. I'm glad that you brought that up in terms of the subject line, because I was listening to you in another podcast talk about that. You know, you dropped your son off, you went to a cafe and just started the Kickstarter campaign and asked TCM. And because that's always, you know, the most crucial moment is how are you going to capture their attention? And I imagine they get tons of emails.
Yeah.
And so that was really, really, really clever. I just the illustrations, as we've already touched on, by Howell Edwards, I just love them. And so you just found him online, right? And then
I was searching hashtag illustrator, or using that hashtag and looking for someone. And so I talked to a lot of people, and I first talked to some illustrators who do work for TCM, like their some of their commercials and things. They were very expensive. Howell Edwards Creative is actually the name of the company, and it's Phil Howell and his wife Charlotte own the company. So everyone always thinks Howell Edwards is the person, but Phil Howell is his name. And Phil and Charlotte live in outside of London. And so we hadn't met. Everything was over the phone and talking, but we just clicked. And he's like, I just love these old movies. I'll do this for you. Not too expensive. So he just was sort of passionate about it. I've been doing work with the Film Detective, a different classic movie network.
Classic movie. And this is a podcast, right, that you're doing there, or is...
No, it's actually like a show. They're calling it a mini series. That's what they're calling it. And we're releasing a director's cut of Movies Are Magic that'll have the Film Detective logo. So this is going to be a Film Detective version of the book, and it's going to have a lot more, it'll be the same book but with added spreads. Some added sections and a teacher's guide and like a homeschooling guide with some ideas for things that families and teachers could do to like little activities and things to get kids more.
That's a great idea.
Yeah. And then the show we're doing, we just wrapped up filming. They sent a film crew here to Sonoma where I live and filmed Weston and I introducing 10 kid-friendly classic movies.
Oh, that's so cool.
And it's called Classic Films for Kids on the Film Detective, and it'll start airing, we think, in January. She said, don't say January yet. Say 2022, because it might be, this might be the first week of February. But we'll have a date soon. And then they'll do one a week for 10 weeks. And if it goes well, we'll do another season.
That's great. That's really exciting. I also just read that apparently Ginger Rogers and Mark Sandrich, the director, didn't get along.
Oh.
Apparently he even got mad at her once and said to go take some dancing, singing, and acting lessons.
Nice.
And I just thought, what? I'm all like, okay. I think this is the how could you say that to her, who was such a great dancer and singer and even an actor. So I don't know what his problem was with her, but just on IMDb, the Internet Movie Database, there's tons of trivia there. But
she is an underrated beauty also.
Yes.
You don't care about how beautiful she is. It's like, she's a great dancer. She was, you know, Fred and Ginger, they're like a thing. And whenever they do a close-up of her, I'm like, my God, she's so stunning.
She is,
and
you
don't really hear about how beautiful she is, but I think she's...
Yeah, her eyes. Beautiful. I mean, she had these sort of watery big eyes. And I agree. I've only seen her in a couple of things. Again, her and Fred Astaire, not someone I know very well.
And they always say she did everything Fred did, but backwards and in high heels.
I read that too. I love that. Well, Jennifer, thanks so much for coming on. I really appreciate that you took the time to chat with me today. And again, the book, Movies Are Magic, is really, really great. And it would be a great bedtime story for your kids to get them interested in classic films. So this is great. And best of luck on all these exciting projects you're working on. I think it sounds like it's going to be make a big impact to help people. The next generation get interested in the past. So thanks again for coming on.
Cool. Thank you. Thanks for having me.
No, you're very, very welcome. And where's the best place for people to find you online? I know you're on Instagram and Twitter, I believe, right? I think.
Yeah. I tweet at Jen TCM, which I don't work at TCM, but you know, 20 years ago or whenever I started my TCM account, I liked TCM. So that's my handle. And then Movies Are Magic Kids Book is the Instagram handle. And you can get it on Amazon or you can get it from TCM directly on their online shop. And pretty soon you'll be able to get it from the Film Detective when we release the director's cut, probably within the month.
Okay. Oh, fantastic. Okay, great. Well, I'll leave the links in the description box below for where people can get the book and also follow Jennifer on social media. And if this is your first time here, I also have a Patreon membership where I discuss all kinds of movies, classic film, film noir, movies from really all over Europe and foreign films, et cetera, et cetera. It's a lot of bonus content that are all with polls that I release every month and people can vote on what they want to see. So go to patreon.com/RobertBellissimo at the movies if you want to become a member. And there's also an audio version of this podcast. So for anyone who's listening to this right now in the audio version, there's a lot more episodes on the YouTube channel. So if you've run out of episodes on the audio version, head over to the YouTube channel, youtube.com/RobertBellissimo at the movies. And lastly, for those of you watching on YouTube, if this is your first time here, please consider subscribing to my channel. It is absolutely free to do so. Just press the Robert Bellissimo at the Movies logo. You'll see it floating above my head right here in just a second to your top left. Just click on that and then click the bell in order to get a notification every time I release a new video. Jennifer, thanks so much again. Please come again to chat more sometime.
We'll talk about pre-codes next time.
Yeah. Oh, yes. I've done a number of those. So we'll do that for sure.
Well, thanks for doing this and for sharing your love of movies. It's awesome.
My pleasure. And we'll see everyone in the next episode.